Thank you for listening to the Ask AI podcast. To get our latest episodes, AI news, discount codes for events, and links to free resources, sign up to our monthly newsletter by visiting askai.org and clicking the subscribe link. That's askai.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask AI podcast, where we interview exceptional leaders in the AI space. Joining me today is Dr. Mara Grossman, a lawyer and researcher who specializes in the intersection of technology, AI, and the law. She is a research professor in the School of Computer Science at the University of Waterloo, an adjunct professor at Osgoode Hall Law School, and an affiliate faculty member of the Vector Institute in Ontario, Canada. She also runs her own legal practice after 17 years at Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, where she represented Fortune 100 companies and major financial institutions in civil litigation and white-collar crime. She pioneered the use of technology in the law with e-discovery and technology-assisted review, TAR. Internationally, she's a lecturer in law at Columbia, Georgetown, Pace, and Rutgers. Extremely impressive. This episode is sponsored by Cinci. Cinci is the enterprise data collaboration platform that enables people, systems, and AI to co-produce intelligent, reusable data products in real time. By eliminating data integration from IT delivery, Cinci also makes it virtually impossible to violate data protection controls as you leverage AI technology for your business. If you are an enterprise IT leader looking to de-risk and accelerate your AI journey, this is what you've been looking for. Visit Cinci.com to learn more. You know, you caution a lot about accuracy with tools like ChatGPT and et cetera in a recent CBC article, among others. And you really clearly and simply explained that these tools are not typical search engines. And this is something, you know, obviously having worked in AI myself that I understand, but most people don't seem to even know. So could we start there? And could you explain for our listeners why these tools, these AI-powered like question and answer tools, are totally different than the search engines of the
past? Sure. So if I go to Google and I do a search for your name, I am likely to get multiple blue links, and they will be up to the moment. And if I want, I can even say the last week, the last month, or so forth. And I can look at the sources of those links and say, this sounds like a reputable source. That doesn't sound like a reputable source. But ChatGPT isn't like that. ChatGPT gives you a very authoritative sounding response, regardless of whether it's true or not. So ChatGPT was trained on essentially the internet, vast amounts of information taken from the internet. And we all know that the internet has true information and false information, and the training stops at some point. So for most of these tools, not all of them, but most of these tools, they may only be as recent as 21 or 22, not, you know, exactly up to the date. But the real difference is they were not designed to be used as search engines in the way we normally use search engines to find information. They are trained to produce or generate language, in the case of ChatGPT, but it could be video, audio, photographs, and so forth. And it's supposed to be authentic sounding. So it takes its training from the internet, and things that are very commonly seen or seen in high volume, and it's making a prediction about what's the next most likely word in this sentence. So you can ask it for a bio, and it has seen hundreds of bios, if not billions of bios, on the internet, and it'll reproduce a bio. But that doesn't mean it's truth about Melissa. It could be Maura's bio. It could be anybody's bio. It could be bits and pieces from hundreds of bios. So we cannot rely on this information as if it's absolute truth, even though it may sound very authoritative. ChatGPT won't say to you, well, I'm only 20% certain of this. It will just give you the bio as if it's real. It'll say Melissa went to University of Toronto, and then she got her PhD from Chicago, and whatever else it has seen on other bios.
Yeah, exactly. And people don't realize this. Like, people don't understand that large language learning models, particularly in the case of ChatGPT and others, is it's all about predicting the next word. So it's like, what is the probability that this is the next word based on, to your point, the billions and billions of other examples that I've seen? And that's why I think we've gotten into this space where we have tons and tons of prompt engineering, so to speak. They're saying, well, you know, what you put in and the way you adjust your ask will absolutely adjust the output. To your point on bios, if we continue down that thread, if I input the three or four different bios that I found on the internet about you in preparing for this, right, Maura? Like, if I put those in and said, okay, write a bio based on these three or four bios for Dr. Maura Grossman, you know, it would give a different answer than if it just said, write a bio, right? And so that's where those prompts really matter.
But if you asked it four times, it would give you a different bio each time also.
Exactly. And people don't realize that. So, okay, so now that we've set the stage and now that people understand how these tools are different, and I know you referenced even creating images, which, you know, things like Midjourney, and you can see how, like, bananas, bonkers, incredible the growth and the improvement of those algorithms has been, even in just the last year, year and a half. But now that people understand the difference, let's get into, you know, the cautions that you've talked about many times in the press. And so really the question is, can these accuracy issues ever be solved?
It's partly a feature, not a bug, that it's creative. That's one of the joys about these tools, is they can sort of generate new and unexpected things. So I don't think we will completely get rid of that. But one of the ways we can improve it are to create smaller language models or fit for purpose models. And like you suggested before, taking four or five bios of mine and entering them and then asking for a bio. So, for example, the tools, if you use just regular ChatGPT and ask it about the law in a particular area, it may make it up. But if you're using something like Harvey, which is purpose-built for that purpose, is trained specifically on case law, it's going to be a lot more accurate because it isn't full of the internet and misinformation that's all over the internet. So one of the ways will be to actually control that training data and make sure all the training data that goes in is very accurate. The other way is there are ways to validate. So, for example, some of the newer tools do now go out. So the GPT or the tool will generate an answer, but it will also go out to the internet to see if it can confirm that from a reliable source. And that's one way of having that extra checking step that either tells you this is accurate or gives you some idea of the likelihood that it's accurate. So I think over time, the hallucinations will decrease. I don't know if they'll ever disappear because, as I said, this is one of the charms of the tools, is that it can converse and sound human. And if you completely eliminate that, then it's not going to be useful for other purposes.
I really love that. The creativity is a feature, not a bug. That's such a brilliant way of encapsulating it. You know, I want to dig into a little bit more this Harvey tool that you mentioned, but, you know, you also said a few other things about confirming the data and reliable sourcing, which I want to get to as well. But before that, I just want to read a quote around these hallucinations from an article that you were in. So this is one of your quotes. And you said, you know, we know generative AI is prone to hallucination. And you said the courts are trying to protect themselves because they can't be expected to check every single citation of every case that's submitted to them in a brief. And I thought that was really interesting in your field specifically.
So let's take a few steps back and talk about what caused this sort of crisis. And the first case that came to court that we know about where Gen AI was used, generative AI, or a large language model like ChatGPT, like we've been talking about, was called Mata versus Avianca, and it was in the Southern District of New York. It was a federal case. And in that case, somebody, a lawyer, submitted a brief that had six fake cases. So the other side went to look for these cases and couldn't find them, even though the citations looked, they were in beautiful format, exactly in lawyerese, exactly like we cite cases. And came back to the lawyers and said, we can't find this, and said to the court, we can't find it. The court tried to find the cases, even called the other courts where the cases were supposed to be from. And it turns out that somebody had used ChatGPT and it had hallucinated cases. Some of the citations were right, but when you went to that particular case, it had absolutely nothing to do with the proposition for which somebody had cited it. Some of them didn't even exist at all. Some of them had the wrong judge. I mean, it was just really a mess. And this frightened a number of courts, understandably, both in the United States and Canada. And there was sort of a very quick reaction to impose a number of what we call standing orders or directives that either said, if you're going to use this technology, you must disclose its use, and you must sign a certification that you've personally checked everything. And some courts went as far as to say, no, you may not use AI for court filings at all. Now, lawyers already have a duty not to lie to a court and not to submit anything to a court that isn't true. So at least in the United States, there's something called Rule 11 that can lead to very severe punishments. There are also ethical rules that you can be found to have violated by doing that. And I think Canada maybe doesn't have the exact same rules, but has a similar set of rules and requirements. And one might say that should be enough, but not all lawyers understood, like we were talking before. Some just thought that ChatGPT was a super duper search engine, and it never occurred to them that it could hallucinate. And so the courts came running in with this very quick response, which was somewhat of a blunt instrument, because first, most of them don't define what they mean by AI or generative AI. And does that mean if I used Grammarly to check my grammar, I need to disclose that? Or what about spell check? And so it became very unclear. One of them even had a certification where you had to say, I used unreliable sources, but I checked them. Well, what lawyer in their right mind is going to want to file a certification in public on a docket saying that they used unreliable sources? So what this does is discourage the use of technology. And this technology can be very, very helpful. It can increase efficiency and productivity. But what about the 80% of the people on the planet who can afford a lawyer, who now can use something like ChatGPT to generate a complaint and to file it? And if you prohibit or stop that, I'm not sure what you're protecting against sort of outweighs the benefits that can be seen with tools like that. So I wrote a piece with a US federal judge named Paul Grimm and a colleague of mine, and we took the position that the courts really shouldn't be rushing in with these standing orders. It's fine to warn people, but if they're going to put an order in place, it should be technology neutral. It should say everybody should check before they file. But if you only put all these onerous requirements on people who are using technology, of course, the outcome will be to discourage the use of technology.
There's so much you said here, you know, about the rule 11 that, like, in general, you just shouldn't lie. It's like, well, that seems like a good thing. But then, you know, these courts using these blunt instruments to almost, you know, very strongly discourage the use of technology, right? To your point of having to claim, I used unreliable sources, agreed, nobody is going to do that. That also sounds like the courts with those blunt instruments. But I love that positioning that you put forward around everyone should check. And then it should be technology agnostic.
Or we also said you should put them out for public comment so that you can get some feedback, because understandably, the judiciary might not know the difference between AI and generative AI. And some of these orders were completely ambiguous and confusing because they didn't really specify what they were talking about. And had they put these out for public comment, they might have gotten some feedback from somebody like me who might write in. Or else you've also got this patchwork where one court requires this and another court requires that. And that's not really a helpful way of doing things. There should be one rule or a consistent rule within a court.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, okay, looking forward again, can we get to a place with greater accuracy? And what might that look like?
I think we will. I think it will take some time and familiarity with the tools. I think the tools will get better. There will be more specialized tools. I think people will build their own tools. So something trained on your personal email is going to be better at responding to emails you receive than something from the internet, which might take any tone, might use any word you might or might not use, but something trained on your email is going to be more likely to be able to reflect in a responsive email your sort of tone and your way of saying things. So we will have more specialized models. I think people will come to understand that they need to verify the facts and check. So we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are many, many good uses of these tools, but they do need to be verified, particularly on factual information, references, citations, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's dive into these specific law tools, because you mentioned this Harvey one, which I am not familiar with. And I know you've been using other tools like eDiscovery and TAR, which feels like those have been around for quite a while based on what I was reading about them. So can you talk to me about, you know, the AI of today and how it differs from eDiscovery and TAR, which is like tech-enabled law? Like, there's been tech in law for a long time. And like, let's talk about the evolution and how that's changed.
So
today,
back in 2008, 2009, I started to study the use of what we call machine learning technology in electronic discovery. So here's the task. I have 20 million emails and I need to find the 100 that are either good or bad for my case. Now, one way to do that is to hire a fleet of junior lawyers and have them sit and look at each and every email. And remarkably, not only is that cost prohibitive and very slow, they would make a lot of mistakes. And most people don't realize that, but it's very hard to pay attention for 12 hours a day looking at a computer that flashes up a document and you have to, you know, read it in a few seconds and make a decision. Is this relevant or not relevant? So maybe people get about 70% correct. So what if you could use a machine to do that? And I could show you that that machine does it at least as well, if not better than the human, in 50 times less cost and time. And that's what I set out to do. I met Gordon Cormack, who was a professor at the University of Waterloo. At the time, I was in New York at Wachtell Lipton as a lawyer. And he was a top spam guru one of the top spam gurus in the world. And the light bulb went off for me. Spam is not terribly different than relevant document, not relevant document, privileged document protected by attorney-client privilege, not attorney-client privilege. So if a computer could be taught to distinguish spam from ham, ham being the good stuff, couldn't the computer be taught the same thing to distinguish between a useful document and an irrelevant document? So we started to work together in about 2009, and we started to work on this technology, but people weren't going to use it just because Maura Grossman said so. So we did a study in 2011, which has been cited in case law all over the world at this point, but we showed empirically and statistically that in fact this technology was at least as good, if not in many circumstances better than lawyers at finding relevant documents or evidence in a case at many, many, many times the efficiency. So that was a decade ago, but it's been very, very slow to get lawyers to use this technology. And part of it is financial motivation. If you were making millions of dollars having your junior attorneys review 20 million documents, and Maura Grossman comes along with something that's going to cut that by 50 times, you're not going to be so friendly to that if that's how you're making your money. So
Hang on. That just could improve your profit margins. Sure, you might charge a client marginally less, but you just said the margins on hiring all these humans to do this is like, it's probably so thin,
not
right?
Really.
Like,
at the firm in New York, a baby lawyer was like $450 an hour. So that means it's about $5 to review a document, whereas a computer can do it for a penny or less.
Again, even if you're charging the clients 20, 30% less, right? I feel like there's upside here. I feel like there's a business case for this.
I thought so. Because if you're more efficient, you can take on other work and so many other things you're seen as having expertise. But it was very slow adoption, unlike ChatGPT, where the adoption has just been staggering in just 1 year's time. But this new technology is not a classifier in the same sense that TAR, technology assisted review, was used to classify. Does something go in this pile or does it go, you know, in that pile? But, you know, fast forward and sort of the same people who were afraid and cautious about the TAR are now jumping into the deep end of the pool with the large language models. And so some of them have been embedded into these e-discovery tools. Now, I can see some helpful purposes like summarize these 1,000 emails from Melissa's email box and tell me in general what she's talking about, or take the tax code and summarize it for me at the level of an 8-year-old, or here's Maura's bio, draft me 20 questions I might want to ask her in an interview. Those kinds of things the tool is great for. I'm not sure it's anywhere near the classifier that TAR is, and that work, empirical work, has yet to be done.
Yeah. And that's really what a lot of people also don't understand with these LLMs and all these AI data sets. So for a bit of background, which you may not know about me, for 4 years, long before it was cool, I was running my own AI company, building our own data sets and our own algorithms, which now seems completely unheard of. And a company that has done that really, really well out of the Bay Area is Writer by May Habib, the co-founder and CEO. And it is focused more on like language and writing. So it's not related to the law at all, but they have their own data sets, which are more narrowly scoped. It's still in the billions of parameters, but it's not the entire internet. And I think that's what people also don't realize. Like, more specialized is more accurate because it will do what it is intended to do.
Right, you can find all the really good writers and train on all the really good writers instead of half the crappy writers on the internet.
Exactly. You know, I think of maybe a really simple way to explain it for our listeners would be, if you are going to a doctor who is a specialist in ears, nose, throat, whatever, an ENT, you want to go to a doctor who is specialized on ears, nose, throat and has focused on that. Not necessarily one who has general practice over here in pediatrics, let's throw in a little bit of oncology, like kind of all over, right? And so like, just like how you would want a doctor to be so specialized that they can quickly and accurately assess the very specific challenge you may be asking about with those specializations, similarly with these various AI tools, it's not necessarily bad to leverage some of the lesser known AI companies who have smaller but more accurate data sets that are specifically focused on these things. So I'm not surprised. I know Tara's machine learning and all about discovery, the spam versus ham, as you said, which is so funny to me. I love that line. But those tools, of course, they're going to be more accurate to me. I think, like, of course, because they've been trained on exactly the thing you want them to do.
Right. Exactly.
All right. My next question might be a little out of left field, so we may or may not want to do it, but I just want to put it out there. Especially because earlier we were talking about these tools now going to the internet to confirm and try to find a quote unquote reliable source. We know history has been written from a particular way. So we know that history, quote unquote, is written by the winners, right? And thereby it's flawed, it's biased, and it really only includes the success stories of the victors. And yet history, quote unquote, then ends up in school curriculum, and we say, this is how it happened. And what's really interesting, you know, with the advent of the internet is we've been able to amplify different voices saying, well, hang on a second, that might be your version of events. Here's a whole other community's version of events. And so speaking to accuracy and reliability of data and power differentials in society, what does it mean to find a quote unquote, reliable source? Like, what is reliable sourcing? Can we ever figure that out?
It's a really good question. I think, you know, one thing we didn't mention, these tools are highly replete with bias and stereotype. So if I ask Dolly or Midjourney for four pictures of a lawyer, I will probably, and I have in the past, gotten four white men. And if I ask for felons, I'm going to get four black men, because that's what it's understood and learned. And maybe that is accurate and reliable. I don't think so. But maybe it was accurate and reliable at some point in time. But you're right. There's it's the difference between, what is it in those game shows? There was like wisdom of the crowd. If you didn't know the answer to something, you could ask the whole audience and they would vote.
Chances are
that the whole audience knew the right answer. Some, you know, more people than not knew the answer. So there's a balancing between going out to a crowd and experiencing bias and going out to a crowd and sort of crowdsourcing and getting a more diverse and more accurate or proper answer. And I'm not sure right now. I think we're very much more worried or focused on the bias and the prejudice and the, you know, problems of what's generated, because we know the internet has so much, you know, hateful speech and imagery and so forth. But you make a good point, you know, what is the right answer? The white answer, according to who? Wikipedia is mostly written by men. There are far fewer entries about women or written by women. So the language is going to be more masculine in that way. And the emphases are going to reflect a more male bias. But most of us would consider Wikipedia a reasonably reliable source. So reliable in what way and to whom?
Exactly. And I think you make a fair point of like, maybe DALL-E and Midjourney are quote unquote accurate with those biases because of the statistical, you know, travesties in society. Like, yes, statistically, we are incarcerating Black men at a disproportionate rate compared to the overall population. And maybe they're holding like that statistic, but that's still terrible. Like, just because they're further enforcing and upholding that statistic, it's like, well, hang on, can we add a conscience to this, whether or not it's like following the statistics? And yeah, there's so much to unpack here. Like, what is accuracy and according to whom? And I do feel like for the law, that has a huge impact, like huge, huge, huge.
I think you're right about that. The area we didn't talk about is deepfakes. And what does that do to the justice system when neither a judge nor a jury can use their eyes or ears to assess whether something that's being put in as evidence is real or not?
So on that, I'm going to share something new. You just made me think of something. I saw this thing. It could have been a fake meme. Again, right? I have no idea if this is real or not. I have not confirmed the veracity. But I saw like a meme, a joke on the internet that was like, criminals are now buying a ring that they can put on their finger that looks like it's another finger, because AI has a notoriously difficult time, like DALL-E and Midjourney. They have a really hard time doing hands, like generating hands because of the complexity, right? And so I heard, again, unsure of the veracity, that people were buying these rings to wear that would make it look like they have 6 or 7 fingers. So even if it was a real video, they can plant reasonable doubt by saying, that's not me. Look, it's got like 6 or 7 fingers, because like AI can't make hands. Like, that's
unbelievable.
Not me.
I think we call that the liar's dividend, that you can basically, not only is there the risk that fake evidence comes in, but there's the risk, like some of the January 6th defendants said to the videos of them that were posted on social media, how do you know that's real? How do you know that's me?
Exactly. I've actually heard a lot of people saying the biggest risk of deep fakes is not necessarily the fake things that will be put out, but more that we're calling into question and no longer believing what is real.
And then when your juries and judges become, judges less so, but when everybody becomes cynical, then they start to look at totally subjective criteria, like, do I like that guy's tie, or I didn't like the expression on his face, or things like that, rather than looking at the evidence, which is what they're supposed to look at.
All right. As we get into like our last 2 or 3 questions, you know, is something like TAR and e-discovery a really good example of leveraging technology in a way that's effective, safe, and accurate? Like, is that something that we can be like, wow, this is a bright spot?
I think the real bright spot is in healthcare. If you think about it, the ability, you know, maybe a radiologist has seen 8,000 plates over the course of their life, but now you have a tool that can look at every plate and compare and make a prognostic, you know, prediction about whether something's cancer or not, or combining chemicals to come up with suggestions for drugs. I just think we've just already seen it with all the sort of fitness apps, that we're going to be able to monitor our own health and I think get improved healthcare. I just think the real positive place, and it's not impossible to think of evil health uses, but primarily in healthcare, even using robots in areas where there aren't enough helpers to help elderly people, things like that, or chatbots, where, you know, in Canada, sometimes it can take you months to get an appointment with a physician, particularly a specialist. And now you may be able to show the mole you're worried about to something online, take a picture of it with your camera, and get a fairly accurate answer.
So this is great. So the second last question I have for you, you know, on this podcast, what we also want to do is show for our listeners various career paths that they can have. So any words of wisdom or particular things you'd like to call out in your career path, which has been incredible. I know I said this at the beginning, but truly, you have had an amazing career and you're still doing so many exceptional things. I don't understand how you do it all. Are there any tips for folks who are maybe interested or like, oh, should I do law? Should I work with law and AI? Like, what does that mean? What would you say to them?
First, I didn't have a plan. I started out as a clinical psychologist and hospital administrator. Then I became a lawyer and litigator. Then I got into sort of tech law. Then I came up to the University of Waterloo and began teaching computer science students about ethics and legal stuff and policy. I've always followed my interests. I never had a plan that said 3 years from now, I'm going to be X. I've created most of my own positions. When I came to Waterloo, they had no idea, you know, what they were going to do with me. And I was here, you know, for a few months. And it occurred to me, well, nobody talks about computer science and anything else. It's just computer science. Well, computer science is used in a context, and people who have more than one specialty area, people who are multidisciplinary, particularly in the world we're moving into right now, are very, very valuable. You can count, you know, the people, you know, I don't even have to market or anything like that. If somebody wants somebody who, you know, knows about TAR and or AI, responsible AI or whatever, they can find me fairly easily because there aren't 100,000 of me's out there. So I think people who interdisciplinary, following your interests, I've just always followed things that popped up that interested me. And you follow them for as long as they're useful, and then you move on to something else. So would I have been further along in any of my any particular career if I had stayed in it? Yes, but would I have done as many interesting things and varied things as I've done over the course of my career? No, not at all.
I love that. I would agree. I'm all about the, like, do what interests you and stay inspired. I've like my own reasons and my own like moral compass for that. But yeah, it's like, I'm kind of money motivated, but like, not really. Like, it's always like, ooh, what's this cool thing? Like, this is so neat. So I love that, following your interests, interdisciplinary, and in a way too, building a specialization that gives you a moat. That's
I think
what
the money follows. When you become the go-to person on something, you can choose who you want your clients to be, and you can name your price. You can't if you're a generalist and you're fungible.
Exactly. All right. That was amazing. Last question for our listeners. Is there anything I should have asked you but didn't?
No, not that I can think of. Not that I can think of. But if people want to reach out and talk, they're free to find me and do so.
Amazing. Well, thank you so very much. We touched on so many things. I really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure.
Okay. Wow. What a conversation. Dr. Mara Grossman is fascinating. I loved her final nuggets at the end of just following your interests, having, you know, interdisciplinary interests, because computers are always used in context. And with that specialization, you can build a moat of expertise and the money just follows. I was thrilled that she engaged with me on the concept of history being written by the victors and what does that mean for accuracy and reliable sourcing? Like, what is a reliable source? How do we deem what is true, what is real? Absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
This episode was edited by James Fajardo. Original music was provided by Mike Letourneau. The series producer was Chris McClellan. To view the episode transcript, stream the video version, and get helpful links, check out the episode post in the Ask AI blog.